You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Since the advent of the Industrial Revolution, people have predicted that machines would make human labor obsolete. Our guest says we might still be heading in that direction.
In a recent article in The Atlantic, he explores a host of possibilities and many questions. What would a world look like without work or without all of us working? How would it change society? How would humans respond when they can no longer find work?
Derek Thompson joins us now. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, labor markets, and the entertainment business. Derek, welcome back.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, for the past several hundred years, people have warned that machines will eventually replace human jobs. That hasn't completely happened. We've seen that to a certain extent. But why should we start taking that kind of prediction more seriously now?
It's true. This is a prediction that has been proved wrong and wrong over and over again. In the piece, I call it The Boys Who Cried Robot. All of these economists and politicians and scientists saying, oh, well, robots or machines are going to take everybody's jobs just around the corner, and it hasn't happened yet. So, right, why now? There's a couple of statistics that I think you can look at that are sort of underlying what has otherwise appeared to be a healthy recovery. For example, the inactivity rate of men, the share of prime-age men between 25 and 54 who aren't working is more than doubled since the 1970s, and a lot of people think this is because technology has taken from them the sort of jobs for which they're most likely to do, like in manufacturing. The other thing is that, you know, if you look at the most common jobs in the U.S. economy right now, cashier, retail salesperson, office administrator, driving is the most common occupation among American men. These are all jobs where either there are technologies that we can see right now that could potentially replace them if they got a little bit better, whether it's online shopping to replace retail salespeople, or there are technologies that a lot of people see right around the corner, like self-driving cars, which not only are Google and Uber working on, but also Toyota and lots of other car companies. So I think it's reasonable to say that the prediction has been wrong, but software and automation that exists today is much more dexterous than the manufacturing technology that was disrupted 50 years ago, and we should recognize that as a potentially scary fact.
Right. We've had in our heads these categories of jobs that you can't do without humans, that machines, computers can never take over. That list seems to be shrinking year after year.
Right. There was this great study from Oxford that basically lined up every single job in the United States from the most automatable, say, typist, to the least automatable, like, let's say, anesthesiologist or something like that. They essentially predicted that within two decades, machines will be able to do half of that list. But I think that it's interesting to look at the far end of the list, the least automatable jobs, and to think about how, with a little bit of creativity, they might be done by machines. So, for example, psychologists are one of the least automatable jobs, according to Oxford. But some studies suggest that some people are more comfortable confessing their deepest, darkest secrets to a machine rather than a person because the machine won't pass moral judgment. So you imagine that finding connected to something like IBM Watson, which roots through the history of millions of people with similar problems and suggests something personalized from that. And it's easy to see how, on the margin, some people might choose therapy, automated psychology, rather than visiting someone for hundreds of dollars a session. I'm not suggesting, I should be clear, that I think there will be no work for psychologists in the future. There will be lots of work for psychologists, lots of people who want to talk to somebody to help them through their week. I'm simply saying that at the margin, we shouldn't be so confident that there is this hard and fast moat that exists around certain jobs that computers can never infringe on. The technology is much more dexterous, I think, than a lot of people estimate.
Well, and one theory over the years has been that, sure, there'll be new technology, but it will be complementary. It will help us do our jobs instead of taking away jobs. How has that panned out?
Well, it's panned out, you know, in a way where there are lots of people who are working with machines and jobs that didn't exist before. This is something that economists call creative disruption. You have machines move us off of the farms and into factories. We used to be an agrarian economy. We used to be a manufacturing economy. And now we're a services economy. And this is all because of technology and globalization, moving us from, one dominant sector to another. But I do think that creative destruction, can be overrated. The vast majority of people, 90%, are working in occupations that existed 100 years ago. And lots of the newest companies, lots of the startups, are much more labor efficient than the legacy companies that they're trying to take down. So if you compare sort of telecommunications companies, in 1964, AT&T was the largest company in America. It was worth about $270 billion in today's dollars. It employed about 800,000 people. Today, its analog might be Google. Google is worth even more than AT&T in sort of updating for inflation, but it employs 90% fewer people. So you can simply create a lot more value with fewer people these days. So of course, technology is complementary and it can create lots of jobs, but it also I think can displace work as well.
Talking to Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, about the end of work, at least the end of work as we know it, and what happens to our lives when there are fewer jobs, when we're just not needed as humans, as workers so much anymore. And Derek, let's turn to that now, a future where our technology is more productive, we have more time on our hands, but maybe less income. How do we start rearranging our lives?
So I imagine three futures, and I call those futures consumption, creativity, and contingency. And I'll run quickly through them. Consumption is this idea that, you know, when middle-aged men or younger men lose their job, they tend to spend a lot of time watching television and surfing the internet. And so it's possible that given lots of leisure time, we just sort of sit on our couches and look at screens. It's possible that this is better maybe than absolute drudgery at work, but I don't think it's exactly the entire flourishing of the human spirit. And so I would hope that people, you know, do more with their downtime. And so I look to the second future of creativity. I visit Columbus, Ohio, and I talk to people in a maker space, which is sort of like a gymnasium of tools called the Columbus Ideas Foundry, where there are people who are drawing and teaching and painting and welding and working with a metal lathe. And what I like about this future is it sort of takes what some people call the third space in our lives. Not the first space, our home, or the second place, our office, but that place we kind of want to be outside of our home if we could spend infinity time there. It elevates that third space to a central role in our lives. It allows us to be creative with other people. Freed from drudgery, we expand our minds. The third future is I go to Youngstown, Ohio. That Youngstown is a city that was devastated in the 1970s by the evaporation of the steel industry. And it is somewhat a metaphor for the decline of the middle class in the last 3.5 decades. A lot of people there are working part-time. They don't have full-time gigs. They have lives of what economists call contingency. They're working as bartenders and also painters and also sort of car sort of fixer-uppers and urban agriculture workers. They're doing a lot of different things. And this is not outright dystopia, even though a lot of them are living with very little money. They do develop a certain amount of pride from the ability to spend some time doing things that they're passionate about. But it's a complicated future, and it's neither entirely good nor entirely depressing. And so I try to sort of see these futures as living alongside each other.
And looking at that first concept of leisure, if we have all this time on our hands, even if we don't have money, there seems to be a lot of evidence that people actually want to work. There's some sort of intrinsic value that the human psyche almost needs that would be hard to replace.
This is a really, really hard question to answer, and I do my best to answer it, but I probably don't do a perfect job. You know, do people need to work to be happy? That is a central question to this piece. And I don't know for sure. And the reason I can't know for sure is because right now people, the vast majority of people, have to work in order to make money, and you have to have money in order to live. And so what we have to do is think about this hypothetical. What if you couldn't work? What if the government paid you a certain amount of money, what economists call a universal basic income, so that you could choose to do things or do nothing with your time? Would you still be happy if you weren't actually doing anything? My guess is that you wouldn't be happy. My thinking is that in studies, it seems like when people spend a lot of time being idle, a lot of time being sort of couch potatoes, they feel unexpectedly a sense of anxiety about this. They feel guilty. They feel lacking in purpose and meaning. You know, I want people to be happy, and I'm interested in researching and constructing a future in which, you know, people can flourish. Some people just want to watch TV, and that's fine, but it doesn't seem like having a life of pure leisure gives one the same feeling of accomplishment and purpose in the world that I think is a higher value than mere contentment.
You know, do people need to work is one question. Do Americans need to work is maybe another
right.
question. Is there something about our ethos of work here in this country that makes this a harder nut to crack?
I truly think that work is something like a religion of the United States, an unofficial, non-denominational religion of our politics and of our culture. There is an expectation that that virtue comes from work, and maybe this is a Protestant virtue. I don't know exactly how far back to trace it. But, you know, you look at the last 50 years of productivity growth, and Europeans have used their productivity growth to work a lot less. In Germany and the Netherlands, hours worked per year per full-time worker have fallen by as much as 50% since the middle of the century. In the U.S., it's fallen by much less. We do seem to work much more than other countries that are similarly advanced. And again, it's very difficult to know for sure where this interest and this fascination with working comes from. Does it come from the fact that Americans are right, that work does give us meaning? Or does it come from the fact that Americans are wrong, that we should spend our productivity and spend our richness by spending more time with our children and our families and our communities, and that we're obsessed with work in a way that is quietly or not so quietly unhealthy? You know, these are difficult questions, and I run through some studies that suggest, that sort of provide evidence for both sides. But it is sort of the central fascination of my piece.
We're talking about the future of work, and you can join the conversation. Have you lost a job or been forced to change careers because of some kind of technological development? Are job losses because of these technological advances always a bad thing, or could it create a future in which maybe we have more leisure time that we'd be doing good stuff with? Would you be happier if you could live comfortably without a job, or at least a full-time job? Call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about a future in which machines and technology could make a lot of jobs obsolete. What do you think? Are humans going to be victims of their own innovation, find themselves out of work? What does it mean to work if you're a human being, and what would the world look like without it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email us on talk@WPR.org.
Atlantic Magazine senior editor Derek Thompson is with us. He wrote the article, A World Without Work, in the latest issue. We'll go right to our callers now. We've got Lucy on the line in Madison. Lucy, hi.
Hi. I just want to say there's a lot of work in our society that nobody is paying to do, but it seriously needs to be done. A lot of child care work. Right now, a lot of lower-income people really can't afford child care because the child care subsidies available are totally inadequate. I do a lot of volunteer work. I've been retired for quite a while now, and I do a lot of volunteer work with a bunch of low-income children, and I've been doing that since before I retired. And early on, when I was in my 20s, I worked at a nursing home, and I became aware that a lot of older people in nursing homes aren't very adequately cared for, and I think that it's always difficult to get adequate funding to care for older people.
Lucy, thanks a lot for that call. And Derek, in your piece, one scenario you lay out is maybe a Depression-era-style works program to hire these newly unemployed people to do exactly these kind of jobs, elder care, child care, things like that.
Yeah, I think this is a completely utterly wonderful point to raise, which is that, you know, economics is not a morality play. The people who are paid the most are not necessarily doing the work that is of most civic good. And on the other hand, people who are paid nothing, let me restate, people who are doing essential work, raising children, caring for the sick, caring for the elderly, donating their time to community service, sometimes this work is compensated poorly or not at all. And so, you know, there's lots of negative scenarios that can be painted, and that I do paint in this piece about machines and automation replacing a lot of full-time work. at the same time, it's easy to be optimistic in this small way by saying, you know, what if we freed up a lot of time and a lot of people and a lot of talent for taking care of and spending more time devoting our energies toward these essential activities that aren't rewarded that much right now by the labor market, caring for people and making sure that the most vulnerable people in our society, whether it's babies or the sick or the elderly, are cared for. I think this is a huge point, and this is one of those areas where I think that a scenario where automation takes care of a lot of the jobs that are currently occupied by the labor force would allow us to devote more of our time to these sort of things.
Lucy, thanks a lot for that call. We go next to Brendan in Milwaukee. Hi, Brendan.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. I just wanted to call. I think it was a really great topic. Really encouraged that it's being talked about, especially in a platform like WPRN and in The Atlantic. And just wanted to comment on actually working right now on a theology of work and vocation under a research grant through Marquette, and working under the direction of a theologian there. And we're teasing out of a lot of these same questions and maybe offering some hypotheses, obviously, with theology in terms of where we derive purpose and if there were, you know, a full-scale automation to replace a lot of jobs, that people would still seek something to do with their time, you know. So it depends on, one, how you're defining work, and then, two, you know, what that work is producing. So I guess I just wanted to offer that and compliment Derek on writing such an important topic.
Well, Brendan, thanks a lot for that. And Derek, you know, he used the word theology, gets up this notion of work as a calling, as something more than just a job. What does that get at to you?
No, it's a great point, and I'm really happy that other people are working on this. Not so much theologists, but psychologists, and perhaps psychologists that the caller is reading. They have this tripartite theory of work that says there's essentially three categories of work. There are jobs, careers, and callings. You know, and calling has a little bit of this sort of theological purpose attached to it. A job is something that you do for money. A calling is something that people do for the status that sort of mastery and developing your career brings. And then the calling is something that you do for love of the work itself, for the intrinsic fulfillment of the activity. You know, it's not so much that every single job fits into only one bucket. There are jobs that pay lots of money, where people advance in their careers, and they're incredibly passionate about the work they do. But a lot of jobs, you know, fall into one, when people are sort of making the trade-off of, do I take one job that pays a lot but does very little civic good and I don't enjoy the work, versus another job that doesn't pay very much, but the minute-to-minute process of the job is, you know, sort of feeds my soul. You know, it is possible to me, and the piece ends on this sort of hopeful note, that as machines and automation takes care of more of the jobs, you know, does that free up people to find their calling? I am ambivalent on this question. On the one hand, I think that the opportunity is there. On the other hand, a lot of times finding the thing that you love, the thing that you're wonderful at, requires discipline. And that discipline often requires schooling, and we go to school because we expect to have a job at the end. And so, in a way, the labor force itself is, for many people, certainly not all, but for many people, a mechanism for helping people discover the thing that they are truly passionate about. And so the question is, you know, how do people find that discipline and that calling and that love of work if you don't have the same labor signals being sent? I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying it becomes a tricky question, and perhaps a question in which, you know, you need philosophers to begin to think through it right now.
Well, if the philosophers are thinking through it, is that enough? Or is our society as a whole, our government leaders, our business leaders, us as individuals, are we thinking about this massive shift enough?
Right. In a piece, I talk about how the government can begin to prepare us for this future. I have a couple ideas. One, which is popular among liberals right now, but ironically was proposed by a conservative economist and even bandied under Richard Nixon's administration, is the universal basic income. The idea that you pay everybody a certain amount of money every single month from the government, a bit like Social Security for all, and that allows people to maintain their dignity in the face of declining full-time job opportunities. There's also, you know, because I think money itself is not enough to replace the virtues of work. I also suggest, you know, the government thinking about creating something like a digital WPA at the local government level, a way to connect underemployed people with either government projects like caring for the sick or individual projects like somebody posting something that says, you know, I'm interested in hiring an artist or hiring a tutor or hiring a carpenter for a brief period of time.
And Derek, we'll leave it with that idea, and we've got that piece posted on our Central Time Facebook page. Derek, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic.